Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guests are Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, authors of The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, published in September by Portfolio. Robin is a reporter on the culture desk of the New York Times. She covers art, auction, and architecture. She has also covered the media industry for the business desk and city news for the metro desk. Kate has worked for Time, the New York Observer. She's also worked at the Wall Street Journal as an investigative journalist and is now also at the New York Times as a business reporter. I believe this is their first collaboration and first book. Kavanaugh is a book about a special time and place in our nation's history. It explores, yes, the education of a man, but also his character, his friends and acquaintances, and his confirmation, and does so even-handedly and with copious research. I learned about a person I had previously formed a very strong opinion about, and then after reading this book, changed that opinion a lot. And I'll get into that later with them. So with that somewhat convoluted introduction, welcome to both of you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so we want to get your name straight, so let me ask this question. How did you decide whose name would go first in the book?
I'll take that one. So we talked a fair amount about it, and actually at the Times there's a kind of a system for figuring out bylines that deals with, you know, who had the sort of bombshell news here, or if everybody sort of had equal roles in the reporting, like who did the writing, or is it clear in any way sort of who had an outsized contribution to make here? You know, in this case, we didn't have the luxury of waiting until we were finished with the process to make that decision. So I just said, Robin, take the first byline, because, you know, it's exciting to be involved with this project. It's her first book. I've written other books, and we figured maybe we'll do it this time this way and then flip it around for the paperback. So it was a pretty collegial decision, right?
It was. It was a generous act on Kate's part.
Oh, that's great. Well, so when you first decided that to turn your reporting, the two of you, into a book, what was the rationale? I mean, why did you feel like a book was necessary and the reporting should be expanded on, especially with the copious research and the interviews? Why did you think it was so important that beyond the reporting of the confirmation hearings and what we learned in those hearings about Kavanaugh, why did you think it was so important to expand that knowledge for the American people?
I think when both of Kate and I were on the team that covered the Kavanaugh confirmation process for the New York Times a year ago, and like much of the country, we arrived at his confirmation date of October 6th feeling somewhat that there was unfinished business. There were notes in our notebooks. There were questions that were left hanging. There was more to investigate and explore. And we were interested in going further and seeing what we could do to flesh this story out to the degree possible and try to understand some of the forces that were at work that made this such an incredibly divisive and sensitive and polarizing issue for our country.
Well, polarizing, so I have to ask this. I mean, I sincerely regret the fact that he will, for the next 30 years, be taking away the rights of Americans and helping to destroy our country and its values. So that's me on one side. Did you guys have preconceived notions, maybe not as extreme as mine, about him before you began this journey?
You know, this is Kate. I can honestly say no.
Really?
I mean, I think if we had any preconceived notions, they were only derived from the reporting that we had done for the Times on this topic. Neither one of us is a Supreme Court reporter or ever has been. I mean, we kind of follow the news on a daily basis, but we didn't have any particular opinions of Brett Kavanaugh. Robin happened to go to undergraduate college with him, and she can talk a little bit about that, but their relationship was sort of an acquaintanceship and, you know, generally friendly, but not at all related to politics or interpreting the Constitution. So I think we started out with fairly blank slates and a view that you know, there was a really definitive profile to be done here of a man and a jurist and, you know, going back in time of a student. And there was also a mystery to be solved here a little bit, or a quandary to investigate, which is to say these sort of opposite accounts of what allegedly happened between Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault, and Kavanaugh, who denied it, and then subsequently of Deborah Ramirez, who was in the same class at Yale as Kavanaugh and Robin, and alleged, you know, many years later that he had improperly exposed himself to her and kind of inadvertently caused her to touch him. And he denied that. So figuring out what actually happened there as best we could, as well as sort of trying to better define Kavanaugh for the public and for our readers, those were the twin goals. But we really had no particular view about his impact on the court beyond what we had read.
And it's interesting, too, because in many of the reviews, they construe or portray this book as like a first history. Like this is the baseline for which future histories will be written. And even you guys, in your quote from the Aeneid, which is someday it will be helpful to have recalled even these events. So what does all that mean? I mean, is this kind of a baseline? Is this the beginning of what will be a more detailed looking backward, perhaps during his service, as to what kind of person, what kind of judge he is?
This is Robin. I think that we certainly hoped that this would amount to something of a first draft of history. We did have the luxury of stepping back from these events and over the course of almost a year, going back at them in kind of minute detail, rewatching these hearings, talking to everyone possible from his background, as well as those who had been party to these confirmation hearings, to have the benefit of hindsight and some kind of contemplation of these events, and what their impact was, why these hearings unfolded in a way that felt so toxic. And I do think that was somewhat of our goal, was to try to dispassionately look at these events in a way that was divorced from some of the strong feelings people brought to it, because this was clearly triggering on many levels for many different people in the light of a Me Too movement during a Trump presidency that has extremely strong pugilistic language. In a country that feels as if people have taken sides and aren't really talking and listening to one another, that we wanted to really do that kind of stepping back and slowing down of this experience and exploring it from all angles and seeing what that taught us. And perhaps it would be a tool that would help us make sense of it going forward as a piece of history.
Well, if that's true then, and you discuss this in great detail, aren't we missing so much, although your research fills in some of the blanks, because of the FBI's investigation after Flake and all that stuff?
Definitely. I want to let Robin take this one, though, because I think she spent a little more time on that aspect.
Yes, okay. I mean, a great source of frustration for a lot of people at the time and during the course of our reporting for this book expressed their frustration at not being able to reach the FBI after making valiant attempts to do so. We had many stories of people being put on hold, waiting outside their local FBI offices, being kind of relayed from to ping-pong from one place to another, and ultimately never really being able to convey the information they felt was relevant to this fact-finding process, and that and a strong feeling across the board that this FBI investigation was not conducted in good faith or in earnest, that it was something of a checking of the box, a way to satisfy those who had remaining doubts about Kavanaugh without actually speaking to people who might have information that could have bearing on his fitness for the court. And so we definitely wanted to go back at a lot of that and explore to what degree there was information left that was important to bring to light. And one such example was an additional allegation from that dated back to Kavanaugh's freshman year at Yale of an event at another party when classmates were drinking. And this was similar to the Ramirez story, and that the allegation was that Brett Kavanaugh exposed himself to another female classmate. That classmate, it should be said, has expressed to friends that she doesn't remember it and did not want to talk to us about that incident or the alleged incident. But there is a classmate named Max Steyer who did try to bring that information to senators as well as the FBI, and it was never followed up on, and that seems meaningful as a window into how this process was conducted.
Well, not to try to paint you guys into a corner, but I guess I really am, is suppose the FBI had done a comprehensive examination and each of these people that wanted to come forward had been allowed to, and 1 week was not 1 week, but as long as it was necessary. Do you feel, and you have to have an opinion, as to whether or not there would have been damning evidence?
Well, I think that it might have turned out much as our book did, which is to say it's a much more complicated story with what to an average, you know, citizen and reader of these events might surprise in many respects. So Robin did yeoman's work talking to many, many of these Yale classmates who knew Ramirez, knew Kavanaugh, knew the social scene, and what emerges is a picture of a young man who, like many college students, was a heavy drinker and was a little bit awkward socially and perhaps used alcohol as a social lubricant and was a bit awkward when it came to women and, you know, very likely, based on the multiple corroborators that Robin found of the Ramirez allegations, did expose himself to her and quite likely to this other third woman that Robin just alluded to in a similar fashion at a drunken party, causing sort of unwanted sexual touching, unwanted on the women's part. In the case of the high school situation, you had similarly, you know, a very heavy drinking culture, high pressure academics, very strict Jesuit structure on the school campus. Kavanaugh was a two-sport athlete. He was under tremendous pressure. He had high aspirations for college and beyond. And the way to blow off steam in those circles was to binge drink beer. And he was very much a part of that. And when he drank or when he was trying to impress his friends, according to people that he went to high school with, he really became kind of a different person than the very kind of measured, you know, well-behaved, sort of bright young guy that he was a lot of the time. So you have these kind of dual aspects. I think when it comes to the alleged attendees of the Christine Blasey Ford party, you basically have two other men, in addition to Kavanaugh, who denies it, but you have two men who are on the record saying they don't remember anything like it. You actually have a woman who was Blasey Ford's friend in high school and possibly the person that would have driven her to and from the party, based on my reporting, saying she also doesn't remember it, but saying in an interview with me that she actually doesn't have confidence in the account. So there you have kind of a counterintuitive fact set. Whereas on the other hand, you have the Ramirez contemporaries saying, many of them saying they believe that this did occur, and some of them saying they heard about it in relatively real time or within a year or two. So if you look at just those elements, you have a much more kind of nuanced picture and one that certainly gives credibility to these allegations. Without getting into too long of an answer, I want to add that, you know, in the end of the day, we also find Dr. Ford credible based on our reporting. The elements that she described from that time and place, the drinking behavior, the types of social gatherings, the way that Kavanaugh behaved in general and in the presence of alcohol and friends, all of those assertions are supported by many other interviews and in some cases documentation from high school. But the incident itself remains, you know, uncorroborated, even though we see every reason why she wouldn't have reported it, and also why the nature of her memory of the incident or alleged incident is very consistent with that of a sexual assault survivor, according to experts on that subject.
But what I would also add to that, to your question, is that our takeaway, which we do kind of explore in greater depth in our epilogue, is that we do find these two main allegations of Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez to be credible based on our reporting, but that we did not find in the 36 years since a pattern of predatory behavior. And therefore,
on Kavanaugh's part.
About Brett Kavanaugh. And so therefore, you know, whether or not that body of evidence amounts to disqualifying him for the court, as well as taking into account his temperament on his last day of testimony, that we leave up to the reader. But we certainly put out there, you know, that entire fact pattern.
Well, that's interesting. That raises a lot of questions in my mind. Certainly with the Me Too movement, some of the allegations women have made are simply he said, she said situations, part of which I guess is also true here. Secondly, I certainly wouldn't want anyone judging my present qualifications for a position. I've practiced law for 30 years. I wouldn't want anyone going back to when I was 18 or 20 and bringing up those things, because I would be as unqualified as many people think that he was unqualified. But one of the things that the reviews say is that you are, and not, it's not at all giving him a free pass. You're just saying 36 years from that time, he's grown ethically, morally, judicially, and I understand that as well. But then, most importantly to me as an attorney, when you talk about his last day of testimony, one, Senator Amy Klobuchar, when he says, you're asking out blackout, I don't know, have you? Or I like beer. Do you like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink? And as to White House, when White House attempts to move on after already being bothered, to his next question, Kavanaugh asked again, Senator, what do you like to drink? And I keep thinking, what if Kavanaugh's in a trial and a witness says to Judge Kavanaugh, what do you like to drink? Do you like beer? I like beer. Do you like beer? That witness would be in jail for 5 months and 29 days, and he certainly wouldn't be allowed to be a judge himself. And so it's the lack of judicial temperament. Forget all these accusations. The fact that he started to cry, some of the things that he said in that final day. Would you two agree that that lack of judicial temperament in those days of testimony kind of lead to the idea maybe this guy shouldn't be a Supreme Court justice?
Well, to that point, Sam, I think we found that many people agree with you, for sure, and there was a meaningful outcry in response to it. There were thousands of law school professors who said this indicates that this person is not qualified for the bench, is incapable of being impartial. You had former Justice John Paul Stevens, when he was still living.
The ABA pulled its ranking from Kavanaugh for temperament.
Stevens reversed his support for him publicly. And there were people we spoke to who had signed letters of support who then reversed their stance as a result. And many people did say to us that they felt that that testimony and the temperament he demonstrated was worse than the allegations themselves in terms of a prism through which to evaluate his fitness for the court. So there is certainly a school of thought on that matter that agrees with you fully.
I want to add just one thing. I know this wasn't your question, but it came up in my mind as you were asking. If you go back and watch the Kavanaugh portion of the September 27th, 2018 hearing, which you were just referencing, he gets most exercised and even sort of venomous when he's being asked about blackout. And he's asked about it at least three times, once by Rachel Mitchell, the woman prosecutor who was hired by the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee to conduct questioning. And, of course, she gets interrupted mid-course and never gets the podium back. But she asks him about it, White House asks, and Klobuchar asks. And he gets really angry and talks back during those Q&As. And it does make you wonder whether that is a particularly hot-button issue in his mind, because the blackout theory of the case makes it possible that both Ford and Kavanaugh are being honest to the best of their recollection. In other words, this assault did happen to Dr. Ford, as she described, or similar to that. and he simply doesn't remember it and can honestly say that it didn't happen, and he doesn't, or at least that he doesn't remember it, he doesn't believe that it happened because he was blackout drunk and nobody ever let him know after the fact what happened until this moment or close to it. So I'm completely theorizing here. I don't know what is in his head, but I think that was a particularly tough kind of series of questions for him because it would provide the key to understanding both parties.
But also to your point, Sam, I think there are those, when we put that to them, wasn't the temperament disqualifying to his supporters? They say, first of all, that that was a side of him they had never seen before. And to try to put yourself in his shoes, if he was indeed falsely accused, that he was fighting for his personal and professional reputation, trying to defend his name, that perhaps one could empathize with that level of heated sort of indignation.
Yeah, I guess so. But what about when he accuses it? What about when he brings the Clintons into it? I mean,
well, what you see there, I think, is this important idea that actually Kate and I talked about on the Daily episode, which is this Republican playbook of this is all a Democratic conspiracy. You remove it from the facts themselves and just ascribe it to Democrats being unhappy with the outcome of the 2016 election.
You hear Rush Limbaugh talking about that this very week, as this is Kavanaugh 2.0, as the impeachment process plays out. The Democrats are they're on their heels. They're trying anything. They're throwing any spaghetti at the wall just to get rid of Trump and show what a bad actor he is because they're so angry they can't see straight.
Yeah. It actually echoes very much, as I'm sure you realize, the Clarence Thomas hearings, even, you know, about 30 years ago. Same kind of thing, which calling this a circus and saying this is a national disgrace and these sweeping statements that seem like hyperbole but actually were quite effective, as they were in this case.
Yeah, and look, I remember Joe Biden back then, and I agree with you. The Democrats now are shooting themselves in the foot, and they are acting at times irrationally. They could have impeached Trump pretty much every day. Twitter could have banned him the first day that he committed hate speech, but we didn't. Or see, there I'm being polarizing again. That did not happen. And yes, so I agree with all those things. But, and this is the last time I'll come back to it, recognizing that you guys are reporters and you need to be objective, and you have been very objective, and I appreciate that. And that's why it's such a good book. But at the same time, from my, I guess, almost advocacy type position, if a witness had answered a prosecutor, or in this case, almost judges, by saying some of the things he said, then he would be held in contempt of court.
You know what's interesting, though, also about that, though, Sam, is that there people made the distinction to us that this was a job interview and not a court proceeding. And so it really comes down to, do you want to give this guy the job?
Do you?
And, I mean, that's for you to say, and it's for the senators to decide, and it was also for Trump to decide whether he was going to pull his nomination. And in the end, people stuck by him. I mean, you see Susan Collins making a 45-minute kind of almost legal argument of how she parsed this in a way that she made peace with his confirmation. So what's fascinating about this story is there are just so many different ways to come at it. And you alluded, for example, to this idea of holding someone accountable for what's for behavior in their teens. And that's a very complicated issue. And I think that there is not a clear takeaway here. It was all immensely subjective, and the outcome is probably unsatisfying to everyone.
Right, and I think your point that you've made a couple times now about how that sort of conduct would be unacceptable in a courtroom, of course it would. But I agree with what Robin's saying. I mean, that sort of points up the murkiness of the advise and consent process that the Senate is given in the Constitution. It's not well defined at all. I mean, the president makes these nominations. The Senate has this role. The Senate can interpret it as it seems appropriate. And in the modern day, you know, we have public hearings. We have a lot of background research that's done ahead of time. We have closed door sessions with the nominee and the Judiciary Committee to hash out certain issues. The court of public opinion does matter, but in the end, the committee votes and then the Senate votes, and there you have an outcome. So if this is a job, if this is somewhere between a job interview and a court proceeding, it's hard to know how to handle it. If allegations come forth, is it just impressions and subjective takeaways that we're supposed to be experiencing and using to make decisions? Is it is there a preponderance of the evidence standard that we're sort of unofficially working on? In that case, probably the Ford allegations didn't clear that bar of the required proof. You know, there was this FBI report that was generated from the sort of fairly circumscribed and brief additional background investigation that the senators were able to read during these short sessions in a private room known as a SCIF over the course of one day. So we, the public, don't know exactly what was in that, although I think Robin and I give our readers a fair sense of some of the key points of it. But, you know, it's just a very ill-defined proceeding, really. And until there's a constitutional amendment or a new interpretation, it's kind of what we're stuck with for the moment.
And it's funny because, you know, like, I have 20 more arguments I can make to you, but I don't, you know, I'll end up being like Chris Matthews on Hardball or something like that. And the whole idea of your book, again, and the reason why it makes such sense is that you don't allow yourself to argue with the likes of me. Like, I'm thinking, okay, I know what I can tell them. If one of you we're in a job interview and the boss says, yeah, do you like to drink? And the guy says, yeah, I like beer. Do you like beer? And I just wouldn't hire him. That's all. Okay.
Sam, one other point on this. I have a few friends who are professional litigators, and I remember in the immediate aftermath of the September 27th hearings, a few of them said what a poor job they felt that the Democrats had done cross-examining Brett Kavanaugh, that they didn't, you know, ask the correct follow-up questions, that they didn't make it clear that he understood that he was there under penalty of perjury, yeah. That, you know, even Amy Klobuchar during that arresting moment didn't actually allow him to complete his answer about blackout. She basically answered for him. She said, that has not happened. Is that your answer? And that they felt that an experienced litigator, although there were a few up there, you know, could have done a more competent job. I don't know if you agree, but again, with 5-minute increments and, you know, a sort of hostile witness, it was hard.
But we also, last night, Sam, we did a public appearance, and one of the people in the audience said, why didn't the Democrats make more of this temperament issue? And that in the end, the sexual allegations were the dominant sort of litmus test. And because there was this question about the preponderance of evidence, there were Republicans were unswayed by it. But perhaps had Democrats hammered away more at this temperament issue as a question of fitness, perhaps they would have had more success.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, I was watching it like I was watching a football game, and I'm going, wait, no, say this. And they didn't. And you know, it's like, you know, because I am such a liberal, you know, I can say, yeah, Republicans are evil, Democrats are dumb. It's just the way I think. Didn't you feel sorry for Rachel Mitchell, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was, you know, clearly the Republicans were attempting for some good optics there by choosing a woman to do the questioning, but the fact that they sidelined her as quickly as they did and then, you know, veered into speech making is definitely, you know, did not speak well of the entire process.
But it needs to be said, she put herself in that position. I mean, she willingly agreed to be a questioner on behalf of the majority, which in this case was the Republicans, and, you know, to have fairly little control over the process. I mean, they obviously all agreed initially that she would carry the baton and take their question time, and they did that with Dr. Ford. But by the time Lindsey Graham wanted to talk about the political sham process that he felt was unfolding, she lost the floor and never got it back. So she put herself as a prosecutor who is meant to be sort of even-handed and working for all the people. She put herself in a difficult position.
She started out in a really weird way. It was almost as if she was prosecuting him. I think, you know, they caught that really quickly. And did you ever see the skit on Saturday Night Live where Matt Damon played Kavanaugh?
Did we ever see it?
Yeah.
I think that's more popular than the hearings themselves. I mean, the world saw that.
He nailed it. I mean, that I mean, from what I've heard through the grapevine, even the Kavanaughs found it funny. Well, once a little bit of time had passed.
Yeah, it was. That was really good. Which brings me to another question, which is, and tell me if I'm getting it wrong. You theoretically could have interviewed Kavanaugh as long as he said, as long as you said we didn't interview him. And then you thought that wasn't something you guys would be willing to do.
Yeah, I mean, we very much wanted to interview Justice Kavanaugh. That was a top objective of ours all along. And, you know, we kept him apprised throughout the process of kind of where we were and our desire to talk to him. And we did that directly and through intermediaries as well. And in the end, suffice it to say, you know, it didn't work out. I think there was an expectation on his part that, you know, we could have a conversation and say that we didn't. And we, unfortunately, just as much as we wanted to talk to him, just couldn't come to terms on how to have that conversation and to represent it honestly to our readers. So maybe another time for another book. But in the meantime, he's supposed to speak to the Federalist Society in Washington. Is it Thursday night, Robin?
Yeah.
So that'll be probably, other than the court itself, where he has been measured and often sort of brief, that'll probably be his most expansive, highest profile set of remarks since this, you know, saga unfolded a year ago. And I think we're all curious to hear how he'll handle it.
Yeah, and at the time he was smart because he did apologize to Klobuchar afterwards. And I think that made a difference. And I think if he, I don't know, the word's not right, mans up to the idea that, yeah, on that last day, maybe I should have handled my... Well, he did, actually, didn't he say
that?
He did.
He wrote that Wall Street Journal op-ed
right.
where he said, I went too far and I kind of lost my way. And again, he attests to that idea that, you know, he had his family and his wife in mind and defending them, having kind of been gone through the gauntlet.
Yeah, I mean, I think he did what he could to kind of make amends for his conduct within the confines of his very adamant denial of these allegations. I think the apology that many people were hoping for, which was something along the lines of, I don't recall this, and this does not sound like me, but, you know, I did engage in some heavy drinking in my youth, and if I ever hurt somebody in that process, I'm terribly sorry, was just apparently a bridge too far and something he didn't feel he could do, either because he felt so strongly that this wasn't true or because he felt the political consequences of that were too great. We don't know. But, you know, I think there were many people out there who would have liked to hear that sort of a kind of a comment from him, and it might have done some healing. But both Robin and I sort of see the point that, you know, that may not have been a politically saleable route to take for somebody who wanted to be on the court in this particular political environment.
Yeah, I don't think it'll fly in front of the Federalist Society either.
Right.
Well, what about things like, if we talk about currency rather than 36 years in the past, and you talk about some of the allegations, and who knows if they're true other than me looking at the pictures of them, that he hires attractive female law clerks and that female students have been warned against him and told what clothes to wear at interviews. What about something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to one of his clerks, his female clerks, and we also watched footage of his female clerks have been on panels talking about him, and whether or not he did this out of this for strategic reasons, to as an antidote to these allegations perhaps, and to kind of prove his bona fides in terms of supporting women, we don't know what the motivation is behind it. But in, you know, to all accounts, he promoted women professionally in earnest over his 12 years on the DC circuit. And not only did he hire female clerks, but then he promoted them throughout their careers. He encouraged them to apply for Supreme Court positions and in many cases helped them get them and continue to mentor them and be something of a father figure throughout their careers. And to a person, they speak highly of him and devotedly in a way. There's a real loyalty that he's fostered among them that seems real and meaningful. The one clerk that I did speak to about this issue of appearance said, you know, she was 5 feet tall and by no means a model, so she would never qualify in that category of kind of eye candy, so to speak. So, you know, we don't know exactly what his motivations might be, but it does seem like he has a proven track record of promoting women on the court and continuing to do so, because he's hired all female women as a Supreme Court justice.
Well, so did you get to interview? And if indeed, I don't know, I only know what I read, obviously. Did you get to interview, if there are any, professors who said something to these clerks about how they should present themselves before the judge?
I mean, Amy Chua is the law professor who was accused of this, and she publicly said there was no truth to it. I did speak to one female former law school student at Yale who said that there was an oblique reference to kind of how to look, but it wasn't dispositive. It wasn't clear that there was a sexual overtone to it. And you do have a real range of female lawyers who have worked for him and gone on to considerable success who are across the spectrum, both in terms of their political views. He doesn't always hire people who ideologically are in sync with him, who seem to feel very positively about him and even speak to the idea that they never felt uncomfortable with him in any way, whether they were out at a meal or in a social situation. So usually, having done enough of these Me Too stories, you do see a pattern of behavior where there is a kind of a predatory inclination. And in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, that's not what we found.
Well, you know, Trump gets away with having these relationships with everybody from Jeffrey Epstein on, where they just seem to, like everything else, rub, you know, go off like Teflon off of him. What about Kavanaugh's relationship with Alex Kaczynski and the various ties between him and Kavanaugh?
Well, there were definitely there was a strong line drawn between them, and there are those who believe that Kavanaugh's denials of having any knowledge of Kaczynski's abusive behavior were not credible, given how close they became,
and how widely known Kaczynski's behavior toward women seemed to be.
Yeah, Kavanaugh and Kaczynski went on to write a book together. They vetted judges for Justice Kennedy together. They appeared on panels together and were quite chummy. Kavanaugh publicly said that he was sort of heartbroken by learning about these allegations and knew nothing of them. And again, if that's one of those situations where there was never any proof that Kavanaugh had been in the room when such incidents occurred, or had been privy to this email list that Kaczynski had, and where he sent around inappropriate sexual conduct or content, rather.
Sexually themed videos, jokes at women's expenses that were misogynistic and sexually themed.
Right. But co-clerks do feel as if they knew fully about this Kaczynski behavior, and it's implausible that Kavanaugh didn't. So we definitely explore that in the book.
Yeah. That's interesting, but once again, does it really, you know, impinge or have any bearing on what happened? And this goes back to, and I guess in conclusion of this, this goes back to the fact that the reason why I believe that this book is so commendable is because, as much as I want you, and I pushed you pretty hard, as much as I want you to reach a conclusion that I like, you won't. And the reason why is because you're fair-minded. And if more people were like that, then we wouldn't be in this uncivil situation that we are. I mean, without looking at that as a compliment, just comment on it.
No, I mean, Sam, we appreciate you saying that, and I'll give this answer, and then we have to run to a meeting.
Got it.
But I think that your point is very apt. I think we're living in such an uncivil era, and I was struck during my own reporting for this. Robin and I did this very much as a team, but the reporting we kind of did simultaneously and separately for much of it. And I was struck when I talked to people that I would say, hey, I'd really like to talk to John Doe and get his perspective on Kavanaugh. Would you introduce me, or do you think he would talk to me? And the intermediary might say, well, he's a Republican, therefore he won't talk to you, or he's a Democrat, therefore he will. And it's like, there are so many embedded assumptions there that, like, I'm a Democrat and only fellow Democrats will talk to me, or because I'm at the New York Times, I must be a Democrat, or, you know, sexual assault is a partisan issue, which it should not be. I mean, they're just all these things. And of course, we had fabulous sources who were willing to approach this project with an open mind, or at least assume that we would have open minds and that they could trust us to represent them fairly. And they, you know, were both Democrats and Republicans. But it's almost like we're at this point in our national discourse where it's so polarized and so tribal that if you went to a certain school and you belong to a certain church, synagogue, mosque, or you go to a club, or your kids go to a certain school, or you're with a certain political party, or you once worked for so-and-so, therefore your views about certain things are just canceled. They're just illegitimate. And that is just so troubling and so incredibly wrong. It really hurts me to the core, both as a journalist and a citizen. And Robin, do you agree?
Yeah, and I think that what attests to that is what we experienced with this book. It was almost kind of meta on this level of we're talking about the degree to which people have taken to their corners and those positions have calcified. Even before our book came out, you saw six Democratic candidates calling for Kavanaugh's impeachment. You had Trump tweeting like almost 10 times or more to us about trying to discredit our book and to say that everyone at the New York Times should resign en masse. You see aspects of our report weaponized, and as you yourself have attested, that, you know, we did not set out with an agenda and we didn't come away with one, but nevertheless people ascribe to it whatever they want to see and whatever purpose they want to serve. And I think that's a real unfortunate aspect of the climate we're living in now.
Well, with that, I think that's a really good summary of why you did what you did, and as I said, how well you did it. So, Robin, Kate, thanks so much for joining us today, and I think this will really open a lot of eyes, and it has mine. And as you know, as you can tell, I'm an audience that's not one that was willing to go into it fairly and came out of it thinking much differently. So I really appreciate you writing it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That really means a lot, Sam. We appreciate it.
We were speaking with Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh and Investigation. And you could hear me going in there trying to get them to say horrible things about Justice Kavanaugh because, you know, I am so ridiculously left-winged and liberal that it's almost impossible for me to look at things from the other side. And that was what was so good about this book. It was so even-handed and fair that it even forced me to look at this with clear eyes. And that's why I think a lot of reviews said, okay, this is the baseline on which all future books about Kavanaugh probably will rely. And I think sometimes the first book doesn't do that. In this case, I think it really did. And for that, I appreciate their writing and their copious research. Just take a look at the notes. So anyway, like many of our authors, it's amazing to me, one, how Rebecca gets them, and two, how excellent their books are in so many different genres. Okay, so what do we have coming up in different genres? Well, Michael Graziano is going to discuss his book, Rethinking Consciousness, A Scientific Theory of Subjective Experience. Basically, I don't want to say popular science, but it's because it's, you know, not a hard read. It's accessible, but it contains a lot of stuff that you're not going to read in Gone Girl or something like that. But it's about why we believe we exist. What is it that allows us to be conscious of our own existence, to be aware that we're here in something? And then it also goes to where in the brain does that consciousness not lie? And whether that consciousness lies in the brain or in what Descartes might call the mind, the brain-mind duality. So in any event, that's the kind of stuff I love, And and then after that, we're going to be talking to Mary Toft. Dexter Palmer, who wrote Mary Toft or The Rabbit Queen, which is really weird, which is the kind of book I also like. And Kylie Reed's going to stop by to discuss her highly anticipated debut novel, Such a Fun Age, which is not a book that I would normally read because I would think it was like a woman's book, but it's not. It's really, really good and really takes on the difference between being black and white in this world that we live in, and does so in a different manner than you might otherwise expect, and does so really right on in the sense of nailing things perfectly. And I just talked to her the other night. We had drinks and kind of a dinner together, and hopefully she's going to be appearing at the bookstore or downstairs at Brickside Restaurant or across the street at the Hilton Garden Inn. So, you know, if you remember where Burlington Square Bookshop is, just off the Downingtown Interchange of the Turnpike in Eagle View, then you'll be able to find us at any one of those venues. So in any event, thanks as always for joining us today. And we look forward to having you back here next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.